Hello and welcome to Q9 Quest episode 425. We're a little bit early on this one. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
New Year, same old me, doing it for any family master. Alternative joke, idiot Doom Spiral did it for any family master.
Well, rocking some new glasses here, your man in Japan, Michael Baker, your Kaiji Monogatari.
And your frequent guest, Smokin' Joe Gamer. And I just had another birthday. I am now in the 40 Club.
Yay.
Welcome. Congrats.
Yay.
It sucks.
Yeah. Everything hurts all the time.
I know everything sucks. Yeah.
One of my New Year's resolutions is to spend less time staring at my phone.
That's generally a good one overall.
And then I spent half my day staring at my phone.
Stop that.
Well, I got a late Christmas birthday card in the mail with a Best Buy gift card in it. And it's like, well, I already bought all the things I wanted and all the sales are over. So I was, of course, staring at my phone on the Best Buy website trying to find something else to buy and didn't come to a decision yet. But it may go towards Dragon Quest VII. It may go towards East 10 Proud Nordics. We will see. But I'm not able to... Unfortunately, I can't apply it to my existing pre-order on Resident Evil Requiem.
You should buy Shadow Labyrinth.
Yeah. Thing with that game is when they announced it and showed the initial trailer, it looked cool. And then when I watched you play it, it was like, oh, I don't know if I like this.
You like weird games, don't you? It's a weird game.
Yeah, I don't know if I wanted a weird, dark origin story for Pac-Man, but...
Not really.
Oh, this doesn't seem like an origin.
What?
It's not that at all.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind then. What is the Pac-Man connection?
It's Pac-Man is there and he's a little shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's right. No, I bought a lot of games on Black Friday, Cyber Monday, other holiday deals, got some gift cards, and got just an ever-growing backlog, so maybe let's play some of these games.
That's a good idea. I knocked a game off the backlog over the holidays.
Which one?
Castlevania Aria of Sorrow.
Hmm.
That's not his name.
On the backlog for 22 years.
Yes.
Yeah, that's Aria of Sorrow.
What's the other? What's the one before it?
Harmony of Dissonance?
Yes, yeah. Those two mash together in my brain. But I just remember there's two games with the word sorrow in it, and they're connected, so that makes it easier.
Dawn of Sorrow.
Dawn of Sorrow is the DS game.
Yeah.
Get it?
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I never I don't know. I tried to play Circle of the Moon and the other one you just mentioned. Couldn't get into them, and then I don't know if I must have done Aria of Sorrow because I don't think I would have skipped it to go to Dawn of Sorrow. But then I got stuck somewhere, and then it got hard, and I didn't like it. But
Aria of Sorrow is not hard, so it must have been some other
game. I don't know. You know what? I don't know. But see, they all mashed together in my head, because I didn't know that any of those Game Boy Advance or DS games existed until I was much older. I'm like, why didn't they ever make something like Symphony of the Night? They did. They just put it on portable consoles that I didn't care about. And they all kind of melt together in my brain now, so I played Portrait of Ruin, I played Order of Ecclesia, and I don't remember which one's which anymore. That's all right.
It's,
and then
it's not hard to differentiate. I mean, the Game Boy ones can mush together in your brain. The DS ones are pretty distinct.
Yeah, that's right. Like. But then they did Harmony of Despair, which was Castlevania HD, because it was on Xbox 360, 720p HD. Ha ha ha.
That's terrible.
Also because, like, the entire thing was we took, like, GBA and DS assets and made it so that you can zoom out so that they're the proper resolution for their size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm currently playing Trails in the Sky.
Hey, hold on, You're not hijacking my talk. I didn't even get to say anything about the goddamn game.
Oh, sorry. All right. I thought you were done. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't even say anything about it. So like you, I kind of poo-pooed a lot of those games because, Symphony of the Night was the game that really got me into those kinds of Castlevanias, and the lack of, like, really good symphonic music always messed with my brain. I did eventually play some of the DS ones, but whenever I went to the Game Boy ones, I always started with Circle of the Moon, and I don't really like that game. So that never ended well.
It wasn't... I mean, we discussed some of the issues with it yesterday on Shenanigans. But yeah. It's just... they didn't quite realize the parts that needed to be more in line with role-playing game.
Mm.
Like, you know, having item drop rates that were actually beneficial and having a way of unloading excess equipment. Or at least, you know, not having the same bit of armor drop more than once.
Mm.
Is what are you going to do with 70 leather armors when you need more than 10 potions over the course of the entire game? Yeah, that's how my playthrough with that game ended up. Is like, yeah. Literally, I got at most one dozen of the cheapest potions and drops of the entire game, and close to 70 leather armors while trying to get those potions.
Yeah, Aria of Sorrow went much, much better. It's got a really cool story, taking place in more modern days. It's got cool characters, and it's the first game to kind of, I believe it's the first game to use, like, the stealing monster souls and using their abilities.
AKA Pokevania.
Yeah.
Dawn of Sorrow added, like, the notion of, like, those souls getting stronger the more times you obtained them.
Okay.
And also being able to bind those into weapons.
Yeah. And Bloodstained Ritual of the Night did that. If you keep getting the same shard, it gets stronger.
Yeah, Bloodstained took a couple notes off of this, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bloodstained continued to refine those soul idea with the shards, and then, like, made the most busted thing by making it so that any shard that grants a passive ability becomes 100% free when you get 9 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love that Bloodstained.
I love that damn game. I got the best ending. Looked it up, which wasn't too hard to do. It just involved.
I like the thematics of the getting the good ending in Aria of Sorrow, where it's like you need to get the souls that give you the traditional Dracula moveset.
I didn't even put that together. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cute. Then, of course, as we discussed during Shenanigans, it has the single best, like, bonus mode that they ever did.
I still need to try that, yeah.
Yeah, if you get like, it makes more sense as a follow-up to the bad ending, obviously, but yeah, it's real good.
Very good game. And I have since already started Dawn of Sorrow, which I don't like as much, mostly for DS bullshit, DS which turned me off the original version, but it is better in the re-release, thankfully.
Like, you know, you can. I think you can make it just automatically do the seals.
I'll have to see if that's an option. Yeah, because right now what it does is you have to, like, input the correct button order. If you fail, then the next time it'll kind of show you, and then if you fail again, the next time it will really show you. So yeah, I would like to see if there's an option to just do it for me, because this sucks.
You're a coward. But yeah, I like Dawn a lot. It's a very big, messy game. Its implementation of Julius Mode is even more ridiculous because it has a 3-person party to represent to call back to Castlevania 3, which was one of Igarashi's favorites.
Oh, that's neat.
Originally, it was going to have 4, and Hammer would also join the party. There's, like, data left over from it, and I guess he would have somehow functioned like Grant Dynasty.
Somehow.
But yeah, unfortunately, only 3 are implemented, but I think Julius, Yoko, and Genya can get all that done.
See, I also played a little of Order of Ecclesia on DS, because I have an unfinished playthrough from years ago.
It's a neat game.
And I was stuck on a boss, so I did some level grinding, and I'm still stuck on the boss. So I'm going to do the quest for better armor now.
It's a really hard, it's really hard in a way that a lot of the prior Metroidvania games aren't.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember, I'm stuck on the shadow boss.
Oh gosh, it's been way too many years, man. I do not remember. The most memorable boss is the crab that you crush with an elevator.
I think I've beaten that boss.
You should have. It's a pretty early one.
Okay.
But, yeah. Let's see. I guess I'll ramble a little bit about what I've been playing. I've been pretty busy with, like, other stuff.
Should we let Joe go since he started talking about his game and I yelled at him?
Nuts. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Dozo.
Happy birthday.
Well, no, as we're talking, I'm playing Trails in the Sky First Chapter on Switch 2.
Yay.
And runs it quite well. I was talking on Discord about how these kind of anime-style JRPGs are a great fit for the Switch 2. You know, because you're not going to get much better graphics or performance on other platforms, you know. Like, it's good art design, so you don't need, like, 4K graphics and ray tracing and particle effects and all that nonsense. You know, it runs great on Switch.
I can only imagine how much shittier that would look with ray tracing. Like, ray tracing for games that aren't designed for it just looks awful.
Yeah, pretty much. So I decided to fight a tough monster, even though Joshua explicitly said, "Oh, that's a tough one." And now I'm trying not to die.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I'm trying not to die, and it's okay.
Dun,
so
dun, 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 dun.
I'm still in the prologue, but I saved the kids in the tower, even though they were snotty afterwards. And then the dad left. And now I had to go and back into the sewers to collect some shiny stone for some ungrateful little brat. So, Estelle is mean sometimes, but then you realize, no, a lot of these kids are mean to her first, and they really are brats, and it's fine.
The thing that's important for any 40-year-old playing Trails in the Sky First Chapter is that you get to enjoy that the most powerful man on Earth is like a 45-year-old dad.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Like, future revelations in future games make it clear that, like, at some point an organization decided that trying to stage a proxy war in a completely different country and blow up, like, a million buildings was the only sufficient way to distract this man.
Wow. That's awesome. Insane. Dual strike.
Dun, 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 dun.
Pain.
Trails is really good. I hope you're ready to play about 18 games.
Yeah, Trails Beyond the Horizon next month.
Which will
put us at parity with where people are in Japan.
Finally. Okay, so I beat the big, strong armadillo thing and got lots of XP. Hooray.
Good job. And I can killing an armadillo.
So I'm 2 hours into the game. I do like it so far. You can play a demo and your progress does carry over, in case you're wondering. Also, if you get the Switch 1 cart, you can just pay $1 to get the Switch 2 upgrade.
It's a single dollar.
It is $1. I'd buy that for $1. Of course, I don't have to, though, because I already have the game. So I've been playing that because I just got that like 2 days ago using the eShop gift card I got for my birthday. So my parents, my brother, and my grandfather took me to a nice restaurant. It's actually my favorite restaurant. I ordered a New York strip. I got something called a Snow Day Martini, which had vodka in it, and I got a little buzzed, and it was nice. And then I got home and spent my eShop gift card. Now, I asked a stupid question on Discord, and I should have known the answer. I said I was on the fence between Trails in the Sky or Bravely Default Remaster. And
you asked it in Wheels' Discord, a known haven of haterism.
Yeah.
So that's a foregone conclusion right there.
Yeah. So I was like, well, you know what? My gut was telling me Trails. It's just that Bravely Default was a little bit cheaper. And then it was like, no, you know what? You win. And I stand by my choice. I'm having fun with this game. So
I guarantee you you're having more fun than you would have had with Bravely Default.
Yeah. Well, I recall that I briefly had a 3DS and briefly had a copy of Bravely Default and played maybe 1 or 2 hours of it. And then I also recalled that I did get Bravely Default 2 on Switch and got about 10 hours in. And then every time I try to play it, I'm in some Arabian city and I don't remember what I'm supposed to do. And I'm disgusted with the low frame rate.
Man, that's a much better game.
Fire Temple.
Yeah.
And also the frame rate is fine. You should be quiet.
Yeah, probably. So there's that. Now, let me see. What else? I end up getting Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom because that was on sale. Yes. And that got a Switch 2 patch, so that is 60 FPS on Switch 2. And it's a neat game. Yeah,
bobblehead.
Yeah, you get a bunch of recipes and you summon monsters to do your bidding, and it's like, oh, okay, I think I can get into this. So I'm just trying to think because our last episode was before the holidays. So I'm just trying to think, what did I get in that time? What did I not talk about yet? So
Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. I don't know. I grew up with those games. I thought those games were awesome when I was a kid.
They suck ass, but they're fun.
Yeah. They're fun because of the shittiness, I guess.
You get to enjoy the experience of Mortal Kombat Advance.
No, I didn't.
Mortal Kombat Tournament Edition.
I won't do it.
Playing a tournament on a goddamn Game Boy Advance.
No.
Mildly impressed by Mortal Kombat Advance.
So
why?
Two,
I don't know.
2 and Ultimate 3 and Trilogy are worth playing. That's all I will say.
I always forget the Game Boy Advance could do any manner of 3D. Even if it's
Advance
bad 3D.
Is not the one with 3D in it.
What am I thinking? Oh, no. Advance, is that just Mortal Kombat 3?
Advance is a bad port of UMK
3. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that one sucks ass.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Deadly Alliance.
Yeah, Deadly Alliance is mildly impressive. It's probably less impressive than Tekken Advance. But...
sure.
There you go. Let's see. Yeah, like I said, I haven't been playing too terribly much. I tinkered around with Persona 3 Reload on Switch 2 to test the performance patch. It's now in a much better state than when it launched.
Good.
It was in this weird thing where it was just weirdly jittery. It didn't make the game unplayable, but it was just like, you're going to notice this, and now you will not notice this. It's gone. And if you care a lot, the dock mode also has a high frame rate, like 60 FPS mode. So that came out, and I was absolutely mortified when I was listening to... There was a Digital Foundry video on the most recent patch where they brought up something I had missed in the interviews, where apparently one of the directors, the producer on the game, was basically like, yeah, so we started work on this shortly after the Switch 2 was announced, and it's like, motherfucker, what the fuck? Ported it in 9 months?
That's absurd.
Yeah, that is a completely deranged turnaround. Like, I have absolutely no guesses as to Like, what the fuck? But yeah, so I would suspect that with that in mind, the Persona 4 revival will probably launch in a much more stable state. Mm. Let's see. The other thing is that due to circumstance, I've finally started up Clair Obscur Expedition 33.
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a 7 out of 10. That's the 7-est out of 10. I don't know, man. Feels like someone who had played a lot of FF10 and a lot of Paper Mario made essentially the equivalent of an RPG Maker game in Unreal Engine 5.
Keep going. I like what I'm hearing.
Like, I mean, this is not necessarily bad. It's just maybe not
bad.
To the the pinnacle of excellence that some fans have placed it.
The game of the year.
Like no, this would not even be in my top 10.
You've played a lot of games. We've all played a lot of games.
Yeah,
so. Yeah, but even in a less crowded year, this would not be sniffing the top 10. But yeah, like it's not a bad game. It's fine. Like I'm nowhere near done. You sniff out at least a part of the twist like 3 seconds in. One, because the writing is pretty heavy-handed. Like one of the first lines in the game, because the premise of the game, for anyone who like me just sort of avoided a lot of like plot discussion, but the core premise is every year there's a big old number that gets painted on a giant obelisk by someone just referred to as the Paintress, and everyone who is that age immediately like turns into flowers and blows away and dies. And it's been counting down for 60 something years at this point, and it's very low now. It's down to 33.
Yep.
And so our intrepid group of 33 and unders are going to try to stop the Paintress. So if you're like a human being with a functioning brain, you're aware that like the person painting the numbers is not necessarily the cause and may in fact just be a messenger. But also like all of the game's like lingo and lore make me think, oh, we're probably in a painting. We're just in a painting. Because like when people die, like characters are like, oh, they lose their chroma. It's like, oh, no, I get it. No, thanks, I get it. And then you like talk to like the one enemy in the first area that like talks, and it's like, I was painted to do this. And it's like, okay, yeah, we're in a painting. Got it. I don't know for what cause we're in a painting, but we're in a painting. Welcome to Mario 64. But yeah. It's fine, but it's also like one of those games where like when I play it, I'm just sort of like, you play it and it's like, yep, this is a like perfectly functional turn-based RPG. I have my actual nits to pick. I need to be careful about this because every time I bring up this complaint, it's assumed that I'm talking about something that I'm not. So the game is very centralized around the idea that a lot of attacks you're simply not taking damage from. Usually I shorthand that to parrying, and I'm not complaining about parry timing. I'm actually pretty good at the parry timing. For a lot of fights, after the first like one or two attempts, I'll just be parrying every time. And that makes those fights really boring. Like, really boring. Because there's not a lot of defensive mechanics that are that interesting when they're just going to, or character upkeep. Like, neither of those is that interesting when the correct answer is just don't fuck up the block, the dodge or the parry.
Right.
Like, you do not have to. Like, the game is designed around, like, if you were to try to play the game without ever doing dodging or parrying, it would be a miserable slog.
Because you would just, you get your ass beat. You would be getting your ass beat constantly. The game's poor balance of how much damage attacks do is built around the idea that you're not getting hit by at least half of them.
Right.
And that's, you're taking a huge part of the action. Like, so, okay, I was complaining about this briefly on My Blue Sky when I was playing some other stuff. I played some stuff like Chained Echoes a little while ago and some other stuff. But, like, there's been a huge push in a lot of RPG design over the past 10 years, especially turn-based RPG design, that when you finish an encounter, you're back to scratch. Like, whatever, like, core resources you used have are restored to you. And Cleric's Cure doesn't go all the way in. Health is the thing you can lose, and you have Estus Flasks to get it back. I don't remember what they're called. It doesn't matter. They're Estus Flasks.
Yep.
You restore them at Expedition Flags. Those are just bonfires. When you touch those and rest at them, enemies all respawn. They're bonfires. I want things to have a second frame of reference than Dark Souls. I quipped this to a friend because, and this is probably meaner than I intended to be, but it really did stick in my head at the time. Every time I play a game that is really obviously inspired by Dark Souls, I have to remind myself that I liked Dark Souls. Because every imitation makes me like it a little less.
Right.
But yeah, like all that out of the way, looking at the game as it is. Just there's been a big trend, at least since like 2010-ish, since I'm looking back at like Final Fantasy 13. That is the first game I can that's the first major, like, this is a big deal game where you finish a fight and any health or like resource you lost is automatically restored to you. You could still lose items in 13, as I recall. It's been many years. But
I mean, I remember it like, oh yeah, they finally took something useful from Saga to put it into a Final Fantasy game.
Mm-hmm. But although in Saga, there is a true resource that you're trying to avoid losing with life points, but
yeah, usually, not all the Saga games have that.
Yeah, not always, but usually. But yeah, so what you get, the trend in especially turn-based RPG design for lo these many years has been that when a fight is over, you just give the player all their stuff back because they want to use, like, the philosophy behind this, as best I can determine, is that the player wants to use things other than just attack. Like, that is boring, but it is the thing that does not consume resources. But the big but here is you are consuming a resource when you just attack. If you do not end the combat immediately, you are accepting that damage will happen to you. And you're accepting that your health is a less valuable resource than your magic. Like, that is the basic decision that a player is making in that context. They might not be consciously making it, but that is the choice they're making. Like, I will use attack because it is effective enough to end the battle quickly enough that I can, that the amount of HP I lose will be negligible and made up for by other resources. Whereas magic or its equivalent is usually very difficult to restore, relatively speaking. And that's kind of the question that you're put in. And you play a game like Dragon Quest, and a lot of fights in Dragon Quest are just attack.
Yeah.
But because you're plumbing through a dungeon, your resources are dwindling every step of the way, every random encounter. Or non-random in some of them, but you get my point. Every encounter, your resources are dwindling, you are having to weigh, like, is this a fight that will take more HP than I want to spend? Would I be better off using one of my somewhat expensive, but powerful abilities that will end the fight much faster. That is an interesting dynamic, an interesting question. And as I was playing Clair Obscur, the thing that came up in my brain, and this is going to sound really fucking mean, is I'm getting some Legend of Dragoon vibes.
Well, I've heard that. But I never played it, though, so explain.
Again, Legend of Dragoon is one of those games that does not exactly live down to its reputation, but it could have been better.
Yeah.
It had some interesting points. It had some good points, even.
Yeah.
It just wasn't up to the same level as much of the field at the time.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it at the time, and I could still say that, yeah, some of the stuff is kind of annoying, and a couple of the localization items, what the hell were you guys thinking? But it also had some really nice plot twists and an unexpected and very permanent early on character death, which was, props to that.
R.I.P. Lavitz Slambert.
Yeah.
That of course, cannot it also be a real name. Please tell me that is not
that
a real
is,
name.
That is his real name.
You can tell that the writers were really into Super Sentai, because there are some definite themes in here.
Yeah, it's a car crash of Final Fantasy VII and Super Sentai.
Which, again, so, I mean, if they decided to remake it and tweak some things, I wouldn't mind trying it again. It is just not nowhere near the top 10 for its system.
Yeah, so what I'm getting at when I say I'm getting some Legend of Dragoon vibes is that Legend of Dragoon's entire combat system is built around something called additions. They're just timed hits. They're Mario timed hits.
Yeah.
But you
sometimes quite difficult to make. So.
Yeah, some of them like Gust of Wind Dance or Madness Hero. Some of those are really hard. But broadly speaking, that is the combat system as a whole. Is that you in a normal fight, you're going to use one of three things: attack, item, defend. And if you use an item, you're either healing or you're using an attack item, which causes you to just, you have to mash the button to make it stronger, or you do the addition, which is the timed hits. These two things mean that any combat encounter, no matter how trivial, requires more attention than I want to give it. And what I've found as I go through areas in Clair Obscur is that after, there's only so many enemies in the game because it's kind of a small game. It's made by a relatively small team.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really only so much to the game. You pretty quickly run into, like, well, that's this area's enemies, and these encounters are solved. I know exactly how they attack. I know exactly how to parry their attacks. So there's no risk in the encounter. The encounter's not mechanically interesting. I'm not losing a resource I care about at any point during it. So, but the encounter is still going to take 45 seconds. And that's more time than I want to give it. And that is a problem that's near universal to timed hit systems. But there's ways to do it better. Like, part of the reason that Paper Mario is like it is that outside of really absurd multi-bounce shenanigans, you're not going to be doing like a million like button presses. Like, it's a normal attack is going to be press button twice, or press button once, and the game is going to assume that you can mitigate damage. And in Paper Mario 2000 Year Door, you can absolutely parry damage. There is no point where the game ever expects you to do a super guard. It's something there if you're good at the game. But Clair Obscur, like I said, expects you to not be taking damage a lot. And eventually you're going to reach a point, if you're decent at it, where you're never going to take damage. Or, like, not never, never, but you're very rarely going to be taking damage outside of, new encounters or boss fights. Like, these things where you get attack patterns that you're not familiar with. And so you get into this situation where the encounters get long but not interesting, and that's a bad combo. The other thing I'll say is that, like, this is a Japanese RPG, ass Japanese RPG. Yes, I know it was made in France. This game...
So it is a sparkling J-ish RPG.
Yeah, like, it, you know, call it whatever you want. This is, if we approach JRPG as a genre classification, this is a JRPG. And it is, like, as part and parcel nonsense as any of them. like, the other thing I will say is that, like, I've definitely seen... I'm not going to name names because it's just people I know, like, in, you know, friendly contexts. We run in the same crowds. But I've seen people, like, complain about, like, recent Final Fantasies or whatever that are just, like, quote-unquote, full of Kingdom Hearts-style nonsense. This game is immediately on its like, Japanese RPG-style bullshit. Like, it is immediately on its Kingdom Hearts bullshit. Like, there's no escaping it. And, like, you know, I guess one of the other things that's, like, this is a me problem. Anyone who's paid attention to me talk about games or, like, tonality has heard this complaint before. This game is... Unless you're dressing your character like a fucking mime, this game is so dour. And all of the music is like a somber piano melody with a sad lady. And it's just like, if you do that all the time, then you rob it of any, like, meaning. It's just, okay, yeah, this lives in the one tone. And so, like, yeah, it's fine. Like, I'm being mean because the response I got from people I respect, there are people I like who I know play a lot of Japanese RPGs, said this is amazing, and it's like, I'm playing this and it's like, this is a 7. It's fine. It's 100% fine. There's some points where the voice direction is very good. There's some points where the voice direction is honestly pretty middling. It's a solid voice cast that doesn't get a lot of, like, range because, like, you know, RPGs are kind of long, and like, the longer you are, the harder it is to hit live in that one tonal area. Maybe I'm just not far enough in, but, you know, you get five or so hours into something, that's like, we need to have another tone, just a little bit, some levity. But yeah, and, you know, it's a dour world and bad things are happening, but, like, you know, you can only go through so many conversations where someone says, we continue, and then and it's just like, come on, man. But yeah, it's fine, it's pretty good. Like, I will say one last thing that's gonna sound meaner than I mean it, but I remember people, like, looking at this and being like, can you believe that only 30 people plus contractors made this? And it's like, looking at it, yeah, shit, yeah, I can tell. This looks like you like, fucking cranked up all the Unreal presets. Like, all the things Unreal Engine 5 is designed to do, that, like, all the presets for it are designed to make games look like, that's what this has done. It has cranked them all up as high as it can. Like, you look at an environment and most of them are pretty repetitive and kind of one color. Like, one of the things that you see people, that I've seen people complaining about is, like, there's no minimap, I can't tell where I'm going, and it's like, I think they took it out on purpose, because, and, like, yes, it is easy to get lost, despite the fact that most of these are basically a straight line, because the environments are really repetitive, because, and I think they may have not included a minimap, both to hide how much the environments are mostly a straight line, and to avoid you backtracking and realizing how aggressive the asset reuse is. Like, because, you know, people complain about that, and that's silly and it's stupid, and I get why you'd want to hide that. I get why you want that to not be something that the player is drawing attention to, but I think that's why people get lost in this game so goddamn much. It's one of the most common complaints, is that, like, you know, even though the environments are so simple, I keep getting lost, and the answer is because, yeah, like, most of the environments are, like, mostly one solid color.
It's not awful. It's actually pretty good. This game and Silksong make me think about, like, why are we suddenly poo-pooing games made by large teams? Like, why is a small team suddenly automatically look more amazing?
I was going to say, probably due to the image of upper corporate culture interfering with the creative process to make everything the lowest common denominator to sell more.
Yeah, and I think
which can be an issue. It's not necessarily an issue, but also considering how many big studios just kind of fire everybody the moment the game's out.
Yeah, the constant like AAA bed shitting is a huge reason as to why we're seeing this. But I think what's interesting is that the standard bearers for the mainstreaming of big indie games. We're stretching indie to the breaking point with Clair Obscur, because again, like, 34 main team members, but like at least 70 or so more in contracted that, like, $1 million work.
Budget. Yeah.
Yeah, like, but you know, whatever. We're talking,
from what I've heard, the head of the studio isn't the one who's pushing the indie.
No, I'm not. Yeah. No, I'm talking purely about audience reaction. I'm talking purely about audience reaction, because the audience reaction to these has been that they are the standard bearers for what indie teams can do, and audience reactions are almost always bad, and in this case are particularly insane. But setting that aside, there is another question, or not really a question, but another point to be made of this. The standard bearers for this, like, amorphous movement of, like, look at what indie developers can do when they're unshackled from publishers, are two games that are using some of the most mainstream genre templates imaginable. Like, these are not it, like, whatever you want to say about Silksong or Clair Obscur's quality, and they are both very well put together games, they are very, very tried and true video game-ass video games.
These
are games that publishers absolutely can and still do make.
Yeah.
I don't think that, like, you know, and that's not a bad thing. Like, it's good for small teams to make just the thing they want to make, unbeholden to a large corporation's idea of what good is or how it has to be made. But you could convince me that a large corporation could turn around and make either of these, and I wouldn't have been surprised in the slightest. Neither of them feels like it would be hard to get them past a fairly major publisher.
I mean, honestly, Silksong feels like the type of game that had corporate interference, because there's just so much bloat in that goddamn game.
Yeah. Meanwhile, what you're getting actually is, like, two paths to the same end. Like, corporate interference produces games that, like, the game's got to be longer or people will complain. Whereas, like, if you're, you know, an indie developer who's, you know, a creative who has no one to answer to, is also frequently prone to just putting in everything.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Z-Boyd even discussed that with the aftermath of Cosmic Star Heroines. Like, yeah, we probably should have reeled back the Kickstarter bonuses just a little bit to focus on the game more. In hindsight, we didn't need all these characters.
Yeah, that one's always grim, because, like, and one of the reasons that you don't see a lot of people go back to Kickstarter is that you make yourself beholden to things that, like, normally you would see them in the game and be like, well, this isn't working like we thought it would, but we can't get rid of it because we promised it. It was part of how we were funded.
Right.
We can't go back to our Kickstarter backers and ask them to let us stop.
Whereas if you look back on, like, the development history of something like Chrono Trigger, where a lot of it is simply, yeah, this part didn't work out, so we just cut it out and we tightened this other part up. And that's why there is at least one song in the soundtrack that has no corresponding location in the game.
Yeah, so that's where I am. I'll report if the game like either pisses me off or wins me over more. Like, again, it's not bad, but it's kind of a 7 out of 10. I've played a lot of games that are like this at various points in my life, and I've played a lot of ones that are a lot nicer to look at. Like, this is very AAA, not AAA, but it is designed to look AAA. Like, by cranking the Unreal presets, you are communicating the visual design of high budget, even if you don't actually have it. That's kind of why they're the presets. So, you know, but honestly, I prefer something more stylized. That's pretty clear if anyone has had the misfortune of listening to all 425 episodes of this. And so, like, ultimately, you know, this looks fine. Like, there's some nice art design, but I've walked through a lot of weird dreamscapes with floating rocks.
It's nice to see any game like hire Andy Serkis as a voice actor, because he's awesome and needs to use more.
He's not just Gollum.
He has been for a long time. Go watch the episode of Andor that he's in.
I will bring up no indie game can afford Andy Serkis.
Okay, that's probably true. That's probably. I don't mean indie game. I mean just any and all games should get more Andy Serkis. Yeah.
But yeah, like the voice cast is one of those things that like immediately is like, yeah, good luck getting this on an actually indie budget.
You're an indie budget and you have the actor that plays Daredevil in your game.
Yeah.
The
actor who plays Daredevil and the in-demand director of Venom 2, there will be carnage.
Yeah, actually, I was streaming the Game Awards on RP Gamer while playing Pokemon, and when Clair Obscur came up, best indie game, I'm like, it's not an indie game, is it?
Yeah, the problem is indie game doesn't mean anything.
No, I thought it was a AA game. I thought it was Kepler Publishing or whatever.
I mean,
it's
Kepler. It is AA. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. But you know, broadly speaking, we don't have indie doesn't have a functional definition, which is why anything that is not made by like one of the handful of companies that has existed for like dozens of years.
Since time immemorial.
Yeah, and like that wasn't obviously. You know, like a tremendous amount of money spent on it it kind of ends up floating with the label because the label doesn't mean anything. But yeah, it's Dave the Diver also won Best Indie Game. And while that looks more like what we imagine an indie game to look like, it was produced by like the largest publisher in Korea.
Excellent.
Okay. Wow. And they had the money to pay for Godzilla DLC.
Yeah, there's Godzilla DLC. There's like a Dragon DLC. There's still making DLC. By all accounts, it's a very good game, but it's, you know, like indie doesn't mean anything. It's a bad label because it is less than worthless. It is used as a shroud to hide what something is. So it's fine. One of those games that like 20 minutes in, it's like, yep, you played a lot of FF10. This is just a pilgrimage. But yeah, so we haven't answered a single goddamn question.
We may have inspired a few more.
Yeah, so I'm gonna quickly
and
hit.
And again, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a pilgrimage.
It's a good plot. It's just this is just that.
Yeah.
The game has a lot of. I played a lot of FF10. I will say there's some stuff in here that definitely feels like you played other PS2 era Japanese RPGs of somewhat unique. Some of the timed hits definitely make me think. Oh, you played Shadow Hearts. You definitely played some of the Judgment Ring.
So, you know, I'm not here to degrade them for their taste in games, narrative, but it does.
Pilgrimage narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, the pilgrimage narrative.
Say,
or
also
the
fugitive's narrative, like Dragon Quest VIII or Final Fantasy VII.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the whole pilgrimage narrative, like the way that the expeditions are set up is like, these are the last hope as people like inevitably are killed year after year by a mysterious force. Definitely feels specifically FF10. But yeah. So that's where I'm at with the game. But yeah, I needed to get to belt out those initial thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I've expressed my opinion about it before. I only played about 2 hours of it, and I got a second character, and she could heal, but then I just didn't like the combat, and I wasn't good at it. And so every time I miss the dodge or the parry, she gets one-shotted, then she can't heal my other guy, and I'm like, maybe, like, okay, I could have lowered the difficulty, I admit that, and eventually you get a third or fourth party member, maybe, fine, but I just, it didn't click with me, that's all.
The one thing I will say that got spoiled for me is that the last party member is apparently a blue mage, and that feels backwards.
Last one.
Yeah, like that, I guess that was meant to be an incentive to go back and replay earlier areas, because like that's the only way to get blue mage abilities. But I'll see how it's implemented, but
I think Fire Miner has about 12 questions.
Yeah, no, way more than that. So let's get in here.
Okay.
So since some of these were related to Expedition 33, I'll bring them up, so that we can just wrap that all up in a neat bow. The point about Expedition 33 and its positioning as the champion of indie games just reinforces the point I've stated many times. A whole lot of people don't actually want to play indie games made by indie teams with indie budgets. They only like the idea of indie games as an opposing force to AAA games. What they really want to play at the end of the day is mid-budget games made with a level of polish that AAA developers can provide.
Yeah, that's what I want to play. That's why we shit on indie games all the time.
Yeah, I agree with that. Right.
I mean, I play a lot of indie games anyway. It's just
But you know, you've got to.
Part of that is hardware issues on my end, but
yeah,
still, it's just there's a lot of cool little games out there. So
yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff. Go play Boomerang X.
Go play Axiom Verge.
The Axiom Verge guy is nice. I met him at a PAX once.
Oh, nice.
Yep. I'm a sap.
Yeah.
I feel bad for that guy's situation. I hope he's doing well.
Yeah, same. But yeah, I met the Axiom Verge guy at a PAX. He was exhausted looking, sitting next to a Wii U demo kiosk of Axiom Verge. But yeah, real nice person. Like, despite that, was very gracious and cordial.
Good.
But yeah. So yeah, I think that like what we end up with is that like people long for the period where something could be made by an experienced team that made kind of a large-ish, that could make like a game that felt crafted without having to be the biggest game in the world, and so that people kind of go nuts when they see something that kind of fills that void. We used to get like a dozen Clair Obscurs a year. But yeah, and yeah, I think that's fair. Like, it is a nebulous desire for something that pushes against the entropy of the AAA market. But I think that this also, like, and I think the only reason to really care about the indie versus non-indie label is that this creates expectations that, like, your average indie developer that's, like, two people communicating in, like, two people working together over, like, the internet as they try to bodge together something. Maybe they don't have the time, or maybe they don't have the budget and manpower to make. And this creates I saw someone joke, you too can revolutionize the the indie game industry by having like $10 million of investment income from your rich family and extreme amounts of connections. But yeah. Yeah, it's just one of those things that, like, you know, maybe the other thing, and like the reason that like I can sometimes be a little cool on indie games as a whole is that when like one person makes something, it reflects their idiosyncrasies a lot, and that's why indie games tend to like turn into why a lot of the big indie games end up being Metroidvanias and roguelikes because a lot of the people. Metroidvanias and roguelikes back in the day were very Velvet Underground. For anyone somehow not familiar with the old joke, only about 100 people, the joke was only about 100 people ever bought a Velvet Underground album, but all of them started bands. like, Metroidvanias and roguelikes are that for like indie game devs of the late 2000s and early 2010s, and that's still kind of in the DNA of the scene, such as it is. Like, obviously the scene is much larger than it once was. There's a lot more interesting narrative stuff being done, but like the sort of like indie, like individual game development attracts a certain kind of person who loves the idea of the immaculate game. Like this, either a perfectly solvable game or an endlessly replayable game. Like that is there's a certain as a weird autistic game design obsessed man, I have seen this like there is a part of me that understands this, but it does jinx the kind of games you tend to make. And there's other reasons for why these happen, obviously, but that's, you know, that's why, like, the archetypal indie game is either, like, a very progression-y platformer, or it's a, like, play-forever roguelike. Is, like, and obviously, again, the scene is much larger than that. It has a lot more interesting things in it than that. But when I see something like a Balatro come out, it's like, yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me. That's someone with the immaculate game autism. I do not know anything about the Balatro developer. I have no idea what their mental state is, but, you know, that's what I'm getting at.
Didn't he dress up as the jester from his game to accept an award?
I would be shocked if he did not, and I would respect him less if he did not.
Yeah, and I see, I thought that was cool, though. I wasn't insulting him.
Yeah, no, that owns. But yeah, like, you know, and Balatro is a game I didn't really play because I know me, I don't care about having the immaculate game, but you know, I respect it. I get why people like it, but it's also like, if you're not interested in having the immaculate game, like a lot of the things that become popular in these kind of fall by your wayside. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was just going to say my take on Metroid Prime 4 is, yes, this is the Metroidvania or Metroid game that I have waited 20 years to play. You know, that's how I felt about that game.
Yeah, here's a big 3D Metroid as we rarely get. Right.
I feel like I'm the target audience. It feels like a direct sequel to Metroid Prime 2.
So it's late for me.
I didn't like motion controls, so I didn't play 3 that much. And it's like, yeah, so... But that having been said, I've played so many Metroidvanias now, especially indie ones, where it's just like, okay, you know what? I kind of want something else now. Yeah.
Because, yeah, Super Metroid, another one of those, like, you know, it wasn't a bad seller, but it was not... Like, at the time, it was a relatively late Super Nintendo game that you weren't going to... Like, a lot more people were going to play... Donkey Kong Country than we're going to play Super Metroid. But ultimately, like, the kind of person who played Super Metroid was the kind of person who ended up wanting to make games.
Right.
But yeah. So let's scroll back up a little bit with this.
Pop quiz. Does anyone know what the best-selling Metroid game is?
Dread.
Yep. The best one is the best-selling. Boom.
But see, I didn't like that one because of the parrying.
We all have bad opinions.
Yeah. But that's it. I just... The parrying made me feel like I was playing Dark Souls, and the Emmy robots made me feel like I was playing Resident Evil 3 and getting my ass kicked by Nemesis, and it was like, I don't know.
That game has really the like easiest this. Parrying in any game I've ever played in my life.
Does it, though? Okay.
Yes,
it does. Fair enough.
Honestly, you know, like, parrying the Emmys is the only thing that's hard, but you're not supposed to be parrying them. Like, that is almost a hidden feature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I was able to do that till like, near the end of the game.
And I suppose there, of course, there's this part of my brain, like, I do have a level of self-awareness where it's like, you just turned 40, maybe your reflexes just aren't quite what they used to be. So, who knows?
But, yeah. So, to hit some more of these questions, here's one that I have no expertise in, but we'll see if maybe Gaijin knows something. What is the Blazing Saddles of Samurai Souls?
Blazing Saddles? Like, yeah. As a joke?
Yeah, I assume like some sort of self-aware parody.
I mean, Tengai Makyo, but they never made a movie of that.
They should, though.
They should, but it's very close to what it would look like. Well, I mean, I could name it for you for teenage detective films. As I saw this over a New Year's Eve several years ago, it was a TV series about a stereotypical late Showa period teenage detective kid. You know, the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
Except that on his final case, he got hit over the head too hard and spent the next 25 years in a concussion or in a coma.
Oh, Lord.
So he wakes up as a middle-aged guy who is still convinced he is a 17-year-old ace detective.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, and it just gets as ridiculous as possible. And I didn't see much of this. I only really saw the very end where he manages to... in the space of about 15 seconds, he manages to parody Iron Man, E.T., and the Pineapple Apple Pen guy. In the same sequence.
Huh.
And I can't really... It's like... Okay, so imagine... So, like, he has to get over to this other area to prevent or to stop something from blowing up. So he actually has, like, Iron Man's repulsor glove, and he's using it to fly across the sky, and it does a very brief shot of E.T. going across the moon style. Mm. And then he's there, and he has to grab these two electrical cords and push them together. And it's like pin pineapple apple pen. It's like words do not describe how ridiculous this thing was. It's just, but in 15 seconds, it was like every single really random item you could push together. However, I don't know what the equivalent would be for samurai films, but it would be too much like Tengai Makyo.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Is there any work of art? Okay, let's pull all the way back. Do you have any idea how Japanese exclusive franchises like Famista, Winning Post, or Densha Deko deal with increased development budget? They are never localized and won't make much money if they did get localized. Anyway, so the developers... budget for games with a dwindling niche audience, like how many people you know are into horse racing. Well, unfortunately, Umamusume seems to have increased that number.
A lot.
A lot.
I mean, it's like going back to how Compile Heart always works, where they manage to estimate to right around the tens digit exactly how many copies they will sell in the first week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually highly accurate. So,
lay off that market data, baby.
Yeah, I mean, for anything that is in Japan and has stayed in Japan, they not only have a very dedicated core fan base, but the publisher probably knows quite a few of them on a first name basis at this point. Because they've been buying these games for decades now. So unless something really massive causes a shift in the sales demographics, which does happen often for the better, then usually a publisher has a very good idea of how much their niche game is going to sell before it actually gets released. So,
well, I remember when I was watching the Game Awards and streaming it, I was like, oh, anime horse girl game won an award. Cool.
Yes.
Bit of a shame about that, like, we cannot escape the fact that the actual horse racing, gambling horse racing tracks have seen a surge in business because of this.
Oh no. I mean,
to be honest, there are worse forms of gambling out there.
But... Yes, this is not strictly involving, like, humans destroying each other, but... Yeah. I'm still not happy about it.
Even considering some of the directions that online betting has gone, this is possibly less harmful for the people involved as well. Is sad
Until someone pisses off a bookie and then, like, you get a Umusume cosplayer getting her legs broken.
But then just imagine the Japanese version of the movie Lucky Number 11.
Oh boy. Man, you're getting obscure. I don't know if anyone's seen that recently.
Yeah. Actually, now I can just imagine like an Uma Musume movie like that. No.
Apparently, like a friend of mine lives in Florida, and he was talking about how he'd seen on the news that one of the big racetracks around there had its most successful opening, like opening business day in like 10 years following Uma Musume breaking big in the U.S.
Yep.
So, not doing great things. Like the like slot machine for anime girls is also producing further hardcore gambling addicts. On that topic, is there any work of art that is very flawed but for some reason became a classic because of reasons? I've never been impressed by A Wrinkle in Time, and they're far better sci-fi novels for elementary students to read. I mean, like, Time does a lot to do this. Like, there's the grimmest version of this that like the ultimate answer to this, the grimmest version of this in like any media I'm aware of is like fucking Birth of a Nation. Classic film, very important, dreadful for anything other than the history of racism and understanding like the development of film as like a medium.
I was gonna say the only legitimate reason to see that movie is as part of a cinematography history class.
Yeah, cinematography history class or racism history class.
Both.
If we want to take that off the table, like take reprehensible art off the table, this is always kind of a deeply subjective one, but you know, like, because like, you know, most of the time it's pretty easy to spot why something was big, even if it's even if it holds up very poorly or is like even at the time was deeply flawed. You get stuff like, you know, a gaming one that is not reprehensible, it would be like Tower of Draga is very hard to game to go back to, very like difficult and strange and opaque. It is also undeniably one of the most influential games ever created.
I was gonna say it's the game that kind of created the concept of an FAQ.
Created the concept of an FAQ, essentially innovated the concept of an action RPG. You feel that reverberate through Hydlight, East, Sorcerian, like all the early Falcom games, Legend of Zelda, all of those have obvious design depths to the Tower of Draga. But, like, actually playing it is a hell nightmare. In a lot of ways, unless you're just really willing to sit there and accept that a game is going to be completely opaque in ways you couldn't even dare to imagine. Like, there are floors of the dungeon you're climbing in Tower of Draga, the titular Tower of Draga, that, like, you always need to get the treasure on the floor, but the way to get the treasure is not remotely consistent. One of the times you're supposed to press the, like, the player one button on the arcade cabinet, like the start button. It's a fucking arcade cabinet. You don't press that button. It's not an action button. But one of the times, that's what reveals the treasure chest.
Oh.
Yep. Yeah. The reason why this game kind of helped create the concept of an FAQ is because Japanese game centers used to have these little notebooks to, like, replace or leave notes to each other, like, hello, how you doing? I played this. But they started using it to give each other clues on how to get past different levels of this tower.
Yeah.
Suddenly the note system in Dark Souls makes a lot more sense.
Yes, it's exactly where Dark Souls
got it. There's DNA there, too.
Yeah.
It's exactly where they got it. But yeah, that's like the very first community-grounded FAQ for any video game ever, and it was a notebook in a game center.
You ever wondered why the...
Back in 1980, where... What year was this game out?
1984,
yeah.
If you've ever wondered why the most... popular Japanese RPG franchise of all time is developed by a company that sounds like it should be fucking like doujin magazines, which is to say Game Freak. It's because that's what they started doing. They made like doujin guides for arcade games. But yeah. But yeah, like, that's one of those ones where it's like, but that's the issue we run into, is that, like, I can't think of a game where I just can't see at all how it became a classic. It might not work for me, it might not hold up for me, but I there's very few that I can look at and be like, I don't get this at all. I think if I had to be mean and think of something, it's Duke Nukem 3D for me. I don't get the love for that game in particular. Like, Doom had already come out. Doom's way more fun for me. Like, yes, Duke is more properly in 3D, but, like, it's still not that 3D. It still doesn't feel... Like, you can tell that they're immediately flexing that the build engine can do areas on top of areas, like, proper, like, the illusion of proper 3D. Because, like, the first thing that happens in the first level of Duke Nukem 3D is you fall down a pit. But ultimately, like, the illusion is not convincing enough to me. Like, it wasn't convincing to me, like, when I first saw it as, like, Duke Nukem 64, which had a lot more 3D in it. But, you know,
Really enjoyed the side-scrolling Duke Nukem games, the original series, much more.
Yeah, we need to bring back the Duke Nukem that loves Oprah.
Yeah. I mean, I used to have, like, the shareware versions of several of those way back in the day, and it was just really nice. They were good games.
Yeah, they're fun little platformers.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it for me. Like, that game's like still a cult classic. Definitely has like tons of fans. Like, Duke Nukem, like a progressively aging audience still loves Duke Nukem. Like, I still like the concept of Duke Nukem to some extent. I wish that someone would make that game that was at one point planned of, like, Duke Nukem goes back to World War II, because I would absolutely play a game where Duke Nukem shoots Adolf Hitler. But
you could just play Wolfenstein, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, there's, yeah, and BJ Blazkowicz has much better games.
Yes.
But yeah, like, but yeah, I'm like, that's kind of like Duke Nukem 3D is kind of it for me, because it's like it's a very big cult, a very big game, definitely had a lot of influence for some ungodly reason. I don't get it at all. It's not a bad game, but like it does not ring any bells for me. Let's see, had a few more of these. Speaking of Mel Brooks, should I lower my expectations for Spaceballs 2 because of Rick Moranis? He was a great actor, but the man is 72 and hasn't taken up a live action role for 3 decades. I would lower my expectations for Spaceballs 2 because, like, Mel Brooks is brilliant, but he's been extraordinarily spotty over the past, like, 30 years, given that he is, like, 100. That's fair.
Well, okay, so something that popped in my head when you said Blazing Saddles, my brain said, oh yeah, Mel Brooks, and then I remembered I just watched that John Candy documentary called I Like Me, And of course, there's a whole section where they talk about Spaceballs, and then they interview Mel Brooks. And I was just thinking about that when you mentioned Blazing Saddles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a good documentary about him. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's on Amazon.
So, Graham, I'm still hoping that they do a surprise announcement that the actual title of the upcoming movie is Spaceball 3, The Search for Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money. Is that was a running joke back when I was in like middle school.
Yeah.
There was never going to be a Spaceballs 2, so it was the next one was Spaceballs 3, The Search for Spaceballs 2.
I like that.
Yeah. And working on the assumption that they have the son of Barf as a character in this one, because obviously they can't have Young Handy.
A little late.
Yeah, just a little. Like 20 something years.
So he found a female Mog to mate with?
Who knows?
Don't think too hard about it.
All right. Yeah. Cool.
It's Spaceballs, so you're thinking way too hard about it.
I know.
I'm now thinking grimly about. When you said a little late by like 20 years, all I could think was like, this reminds me of the infamously delayed sci-fi short story collection, The Last Dangerous Visions, it was a book that was being edited by Harlan Ellison. It was supposed to be and it did finally come out in October of 2024. It was the sequel to Dangerous Visions, a short story collection from 1967, and again Dangerous Visions, a short story collection from 1972. Harlan Ellison had commissioned stories for it for decades, like at various points, and so you reach the point where by the time you get to the 2000s, there were people which is to say 20 years before it finally came out in 2024, there were people who had written short stories for it who had been dead for 20 years.
Oh man.
One of the grimmest things you'll ever see, if you look at the list of things in The Last Dangerous Visions, is that Wikipedia's list has like a little cross next to every author who is dead whose story is in it. There's one of my favorites in terms of how grim this is. One of the short stories.
This is from last year. That's how I haven't heard of it. Okay.
Yeah, this just finally came out last year. One of the short stories in this is called Himself in Anachron by Cordwainer Smith, who's like a real.
Oh, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, real old school science fiction writer. This man died in 1966.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was like. Lord. Yeah, this is a long time ago.
Yeah.
James Gunn, yeah. Bob Shaw, Bruce Sterling, and McCaffrey. Wow, I mean, how many people do I recognize? Whoa.
Is Anne McCaffrey still alive?
No.
Oh, no, she died like 20 something years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I tried to read one of those dragon books and didn't get very far.
I was a big fan in middle school, but I read all sorts of stuff in middle school.
One of these short stories was written by Doris Pitkin Buck, who was born in 1898 and died in 1980.
Wow. Let's see here. Jerry Pournelle. Okay. What's here? Ay, ay, ay.
Alfred Bester.
God,
he lived longer than half these people. He died in 1987.
Yeah. Clifford D. Sumac. Yeah.
It really is impossible to describe how late The Last Dangerous Vision was. It would be quite fair to say that it came out about 50 years after it was supposed to.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I've read himself in Anachron before.
A lot of these, like,
yes, because they had to have pulled that one out of a backlisting from some. I read a lot of collections of stuff from the 60s as well. That's why I'm even familiar with Cordwainer Smith.
So one of the things that ended up happening because this book took so goddamn long,
and Herbert
was that Warcock. He had. So one of the things that had happened because the book took so goddamn long was that some of the things he had licensed, like the people who had licensed, like the people who had licensed it to him, their estates were like, we don't want this to just sit there unpublished forever. We're publishing it.
Yeah.
And then, like, there were legal disputes around those stories because it was like, no, this was for my book.
And at least one of them noted as, like, withdrawn.
Yeah. There was some withdrawn ones.
Yeah. Okay. Just a really odd, very long series. Long, weird list of stuff.
Yeah. That's Dangerous Visions for you.
As of early 2025, over 40 stories purchased for Last Dangerous Visions have been published elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. There we go. I read it in the retrospective collection.
Yep.
That's where I read the thing. Okay.
I
recognize that title. Oh, that's one where Ellison threatened to sue the Science Fiction Association for it.
Yep. Let's see. Here's a quick one that we can make our decision on. Which an Alien versus Predator or Sadako versus Kayako?
Sadako versus who?
Kayako.
Who's Kayako?
I think that's the girl from The Grudge.
What is the question?
What is the worst of these three crossover horror films?
I didn't see any of them. Couldn't tell you.
I mean,
Alien versus Predator is pretty bad.
Grudge. How would you even manage that? Because they're not interested in each other. They just go for mortals.
I don't know, but they released it. It exists.
It exists?
Yes. Sadako versus Kayako is a real film.
Oh. How? Okay.
I don't know. It is Ring versus Ju-on the Grudge.
I'm not sure how that would work.
By all accounts, not terribly well. Yeah, so that happened for some reason. Let's see. What else we got?
Well, I was going to say, earlier, you were saying how, you know, if indie studios were able to just do whatever they want, they just throw whatever they want in there or something to that effect. And then later on, you were talking about A Wrinkle in Time. And the thing is, I watched the final season of Stranger Things.
Oh, Lord.
And
I'm going to go to sleep now.
And there were constant references to A Wrinkle in Time, and I never read it. And also, man, I really think the final season and especially the final episode could have benefited from more editorial oversight.
I disagree. You're fired.
The final episode was 2 hours long and only needed to be maybe 1 hour.
No, it didn't. It's not a show about weird monsters. It's about the fucking characters.
Yeah.
You're wrong. You're fired. Get out of here.
Okay.
Perhaps the final episode should have been broken into two or three episodes to better manage the plot line along.
Yes, the entire season should have been split into more episodes and had better editing.
Nope, you're wrong.
Okay.
I hate Stranger Things fans that whine about this.
Okay.
You're totally wrong. It is not...
I have no horse in this game because I've never actually seen anything of that entire series. I'm just going by vibes here. And general...
This is how the show has played out since the beginning. This is not any different from any of the other seasons. I don't understand any of these complaints. It's bizarre to me. Okay. Did you watch any of the other
times? It's like you have this perfect idea of what the last season should be, and there's no way they could possibly manage that.
Yes,
because you don't actually know what the perfect final season will be, or the fans don't.
Okay. It ties up all the important things of the show. All the important things. I don't care about any logical loopholes about the fucking monsters or wormholes or who gives a shit. The show is about the characters, and the monsters are just the setting. And people mm-hmm. get over-obsessed with that thing. I've seen it happen with other shows. It happened with Lost, but Lost also sucked near the end anyway. I've seen it compared to the ending to Game of Thrones, which was ridiculous because that...
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. That's just mean.
Okay. It's been a show about these characters and their adventures, and like all the nitty gritty of said adventures is not the point. And if you're obsessed with that, you're watching the wrong show.
Yeah, I thought there was too much emphasis on 80s nostalgia in the later seasons.
Bro, what show are you watching? Nope. My friend!
I'm gonna fall the fuck asleep. Jesus.
What are you talking about?
Okay, I watched a show and tried to tie it into things that we talked about earlier in the
episode. Yes, you've hit it. Unfortunately, you've hit a topic that pisses me off.
Okay.
Because I've seen nothing but whining about this wonderful final season to a great
show. Seen you in the timeout chair.
I've seen nothing but positive things about it, and I was scratching my head about it, but okay.
I've seen
plenty of both. I've seen plenty of whining and praise. So, and I can understand how algorithms might just throw this opposite at you the wrong way.
Like anything else, it's an imperfect show with an imperfect season, but it is not any different than any other season, so I don't... If you've liked other seasons of Stranger Things, except maybe season 2, which is kind of bad, like, I don't understand how you wouldn't enjoy this season.
Well, I thought season 3 and... I thought 3 and 4 were kind of bad, and to me, 5 just doubled down on things I didn't like about then 3 and 4.
I have some bad news to you, friend. You don't like Stranger Things.
Maybe I don't. I loved the first season. The first season was like this homage to all of Spielberg's best work, you know, like Poltergeist and E.T. and Goonies, and I loved it, and then they went in a totally different direction after that.
They really did not.
Okay.
Okay, so does Fire Miner have any other questions?
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
Already?
No, I'm just scene changing so that we can move on. Let's see. Sometimes artists are lucky and get someone really with a really colorful background to be their advisor, such as the case with Metal Gear Solid and Motosada Mori, their military advisor. Sometimes the opposite happens, and you get Bloodsport, which is based on the life story of a total fraud. Frank Dukes is a weird dude. That's me editorializing.
I didn't know that was based on a real person.
It's based on what a real person said about himself.
Ah, I see.
It needs to be understood that Frank Dukes, like, there's some very good information about Bloodsport. If you care to look it up, but the thing that's fascinating about him, and I'm probably going to end up like stealing a bit from beloved internet longtime internet comedian Sean Baby, who once described that like Frank Dukes is like a super weird liar because he just like he would rather like he will continue to constantly lie over and over to get to. Like, cover up the previous lie. He will never admit to any of them. Like, just create stranger and stranger conspiracies to make all of them work. But, yeah, just a genuinely bizarre human being. But, yeah. How many games, movies, etc. have failed because of having terrible advisors that succeeded in spite of it? I've already brought up Rogue Warrior in a previous question. Yeah, anyone not aware of Rogue Warrior, that is also based off of the claims of a life story by a consummate liar. Also, the only good thing to come out of Rogue Warrior is the bit where Mickey Rourke, the protagonist voice actor, they just like shitpost, like the credits roll and it's just like an absolutely deranged shitpost where they've just edited his all of his like voice barks into an insane pseudo rap song. You know, I don't want to think about this right now anymore. I'm too busy being caught up by remembering Rogue Warrior God. Yeah, that was quote unquote based on the life of Richard Marchenko, who like definitely was in the military at some point, probably, but also just lies a lot. let's see. You know what I should have talked about that I thought was cool that I did recently? I saw the new Lupin the Third movie. That was a cool movie.
Oh, cool.
Lupin the Third, the Immortal Bloodline, a very strange, one of the sillier, weirder takes on it, like a follow up to a bunch of semi recent OVAs with a director who had previously worked on things like Redline, so it's very gorgeous. I just wanted to talk about that because that was really cool, and that was got a very short U.S. theatrical run, which is to say, I think tomorrow, as of this recording, is the last day that you can see it. Jeez.
Wow.
Yeah, very, very short. 3 days. But very, very cool film. See it when it hits some sort of streaming service. I will say that, like, its plot is completely bonkers. Like, real bonkers. But it also fundamentally has it understands one of my favorite aspects of the Lupin dynamic, which is to say that if Zenigata thinks that Lupin is dead or dying, he is inconsolable and will do basically anything Lupin asks. let's see. Having finished Ninja Gaiden 4 during the holidays, I can confidently say that it's a platinum game, and anyone looking forward to another Ninja Gaiden 2 should turn away. That said, it's interesting to think that the character action genre basically diverged into two lineages, the DMC, Capcom, Platinum lines, and the Ninja Gaiden Koei Tecmo line. Yeah, I mean, like, if you go back to... Wheels, is your stream still working?
Looks like it to me.
Okay, it's just completely on my end. It had just stopped moving, so I wasn't sure. But yeah, like I mean, if you go back all the way to the original Ninja Gaiden, you can see a very like the original. When I say original Ninja Gaiden, I mean the character action Ninja Gaiden, the original Xbox version. You can see a very different tack being taken. Because, like, yes, if you're really good at Ninja Gaiden, you can do very stylish things, but your stylish things always kind of need to be efficient first, stylish second. Whereas Devil May Cry immediately creates a design space where being stylish can be both means and end. It can be your primary purpose. You do things that... to put it another way, there's not a taunt button in Ninja Gaiden. but yeah, so those two things end up producing different things. And like, one of the things I would say is that a lot of the Ninja Gaiden section of that kind of just turned into, like, from Team Ninja itself, it turned into like Neo and Stranger of Paradise. But like, that is kind of the thing, is that like, the game is generally not going to be as interested in rewarding you for showboating. It wants you to be efficient first, and sometimes efficiency will be cool. And yeah, the
the Devil May Cry lineage that, like, follows over to Platinum because a lot of the same people end up there is a little different. I will say you get some things that are more like this than others. I would say Metal Gear Rising actually has a fair bit of Ninja Gaiden DNA in it. You can absolutely be stylish in Metal Gear Rising, but it is a game that generally rewards brutal efficiency because one of its core grading criteria is how many enemies you Zandatsu, and that requires you to kill them pretty, like, if, like, you have to be pretty effective in how you're killing, because, like, that requires very precise cuts to get, and generally, the more that you hit an enemy, the more likely it is that you will not be given the opportunity to use the Zandatsu. That would be what I would consider the fundamental difference in the split in the lineage. Is like, is style what it looks like when you're really good at the game, or is style an act of how the game is played? Ninja Gaiden 4 is at its best during sections where Platinum stopped trying to be Team Ninja and instead being loud and juvenile like DMC, or more like Bayonetta 3, I should say. It feels like the game really is the division that split the old fans of Platinum who went back to the DMC 3 days. Would not surprise me. I would imagine that, like, we will not see much more of that Platinum given the direction the company has been going over the past few years. But I'm glad that, like, it sounds like Ninja Gaiden 4 is at least good, even if it's not necessarily Ninja Gaiden 4 as we would have understood it at one time.
It's nice to see that franchise back in general.
Yeah, that and Rage Band.
Yeah, Rage Band is great. I would love if we could get just more of both. That'd be cool.
Let's see. So I'm going to hit a couple more of the more recent ones. That rolled up while we were discussing I'm just gonna hit some of the most recent ones that have some bits behind them so that he's at least getting his money's worth. Okay, these doujin games from Japan. Okay, I think there should be a conversation about how doujin games nowadays are not really doujin games, and what Japanese fans are buying at conventions are just the drafts of some games that will soon show up on Steam. Doujin games from Japan are elsewhere.
Is this just a different version of the "is it an indie game" conversation?
It definitely started when we were having the indie game conversation. Okay. But let me finish out his question.
Okay.
At least doujin games from Japan or elsewhere can be put on Steam, whose customers are used to paying for their products. There are some publishers in America, France, and Spain release doujin comics and original comics from doujin creators, but from what I've heard, they all made pennies because scanlation culture is too entrenched. Some of them had already gone under. And even if people aren't willing to wait for someone to translate the materials, they sure can wait for someone to pirate the official localization. It's the same thing with localizing anime again. Yeah, I mean, like, that's one of these things, like, the culture becomes, why would I... The odds of me ever getting these officially are low, and by the time I would, it's too late. I've long since, like, experienced them a number of times, and only the most devoted person is going to pay for them at that stage. That's the way it goes. Boutique publishers tend to run into this issue when they try to make this happen. You want to know why Tower of Draga ruined arcade gaming? No arcade game before it had munched that many quarters and still left the player feeling hopeless. Fair point.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
How many arcade games after Draga learned the right lesson? For the arcade operators, not for us. From that game, I'll go as far as to say SNK bosses owe their existence to Draga. There's elements of it. It's not the most horrifying thing I ever saw done in an arcade cab, but it's like the notion of a game having utterly Byzantine hidden mechanics as an intentional feature rather than because, like, it was very hard to explain them. Like,
Drog is definitely doing things just to confuse you sometimes. But yeah, like certain elements of cooperative community solutions, definitely as a concept of how games are designed, is owed to Draga. It's wild to think about, because Draga has like 3 or 4 sequels and none of them's anywhere near as important. Let's see, what are the, like, they all have fucking weird names because they're not, none of them's called like Tower of Draga 2. Yeah, Return of Ishtar, Quest of Ki. Like,
what?
Huh?
Yeah, yep. you've never, like, even hardcore nerds, like, you're not going to find a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about the Return of Ishtar. Because, like, it was the big one. Although, like, Return of Ishtar does at least have the honor of having in its MSX release a Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack, so that's always nice.
Ooh.
But yeah, very, very like Draga becoming the biggest deals ever, and every video game owing, like every Japanese video game and plenty of American ones by proxy, owing some of their DNA to it, like the fucking Genghis Khan of video games. Let's see. What about the fact that Noah Schnapp is so bad at acting? Oh god, no, we're not doing this thing because I don't need to hear Wheels have another connection.
No, what's the question?
No, we're not having it.
No, what's the question?
Though? You're brown.
No,
it's not even a question.
Okay.
I don't think any of them are bad actors.
But yeah. So,
oh, I wouldn't even have anything to say about that other than what Joe said.
Yeah. But yeah, in any case, yeah, so that's the most recent set of questions. My voice is giving out and I have work in the morning, so we might want to start hearing about where we can purchase books.
Well, speaking of which, the author's birthday sale is starting on the 8th.
It's something that should be starting soon.
Yeah, officially starting sometime early in the morning and Pacific Standard Time, I guess. I have no idea how they set these things up properly because I have no control over the actual timing. Just I say this day to that day and hope for the best. But yeah, so it will be all volumes of Princesses of the Pizza Parlor at 67% or better discount. First episode and shorter side stories are free. Most everything else is like 99 cents or so. So if you enjoy tabletop role-playing games, if you enjoy other people experiencing tabletop role-playing games and just enjoying the experience vicariously through them, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, available on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Author's birthday sale is the 8th through either the 12th or the 13th, depending on the episode volume and whether or not Amazon thinks that it's encroaching too close to the end of some period or something. It got weird. I'm trying to set this up. Really annoying. But yeah, that's the big news for this week. Yeah.
Joe, where can we find you?
Okay. At this point, I'm still doing RP Gamer Twitch streaming 2 nights a week, Tuesday night, Thursday night. I'm still doing Pokemon. I'm in the Mega Dimension DLC, and it's just great. You use berries to make donuts and use the donuts to go into hyperspace where you find lots of candy, and it's great. So I got to the... I was doing the post game from the original main scenario, and I did catch the 3 legendary Pokemon, and it was fun, wasn't that difficult. Then I go over into the DLC and got my ass kicked by a giant plate of sushi. So it's actually it was a Tatsugiri in its mega evolved form, and it's wild. So I'm planning on streaming that two nights a week until I finish it or something, or until I feel like playing something else. I'm not sure. And I haven't been doing any streaming on my own Twitch channel. I'm not planning on it, so we don't really have to check that out. And on my YouTube channel, I've been working on my annual holiday buying guide series. So I got off to a late start, but I knocked out a few more episodes earlier this week or last week, whatever. So if you go over to YouTube under Smoke and Joe Gamer, you can find I covered a bunch of different games. And so I did a video for, let's see, I did Avowed, I did Trails in the Sky, I did Hot Shots Golf, Sonic Racing Cross Worlds, Mario Kart World. You know, so basically games that came out over the past year. I just give you my unfiltered opinion about them and help you decide if you want to buy them or not. The goal is just to be as informative as possible so you can make an educated decision. At this point, there's still some sales going on, so those videos might still be worth checking out. There's a couple games I didn't cover. Yes, there's a few games I didn't cover because I didn't want to spoil anything. So you will not find videos for Donkey Kong Bonanza or Pokemon Legends ZA, only because I beat the games and any attempt to show you footage would just be massive spoilers.
But they're really good.
They're amazing, and I recommend them, and maybe they'll get their own videos at some point. I mean, Mario Kart World got an hour-long video where I just do a complete overview of the whole thing, everything I like, everything I don't like. So if you'd like to check those out, that would be great. You know, I need the views and the subscribers and all that. Yeah, and the only other thing I didn't mention before is I did use a Steam gift card to get Dragon's Dogma 2. That game has a trial that I played a long time ago, but it let me pick up where I left off, so all my characters are like level 8 right now. So that's something else that I've been playing. I'd like to continue playing. And then, actually right now I'm playing a little bit of Civilization 7 because I did get another DLC pack as a Christmas gift. Or actually, no, it was a birthday gift. So what happened was when we were out to dinner, my brother was like, oh, I was going to get you something on your Steam wish list, but it's empty. I said, oh, I can fix that. So I got the, I got a Civilization 7 DLC pack, the Right to Rule collection, I think it is. So I'm playing as Lakshmi Bai, and I'm playing as Assyria, and I beat the tar out of some other leader and taken over half of this continent that I'm on, and I'm almost done with the Antiquity Age. So I think it was a good gift, a good present. I'd like to put more time into this game and try to master it. And maybe this will get some kind of video. Like, I had always planned on doing some kind of tutorial video, but it just took me a long time for me to learn it. And now I think I'm ready to explain it to other people if they need help with that. So maybe that'll pop up on YouTube. Be sure to check that out if you don't mind. You can follow me on Blue Sky, although I am trying to spend less time on social media and staring at my phone in general. So that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Oh man, I gotta get back in the swing of things. You can catch us on my podcast by checking twitch.tv/rpgamer or twitch.tv/asswheels on Mondays at 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also catch our sister show Shenanigans at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. My brain is fucking dying.
Don't forget what's going on in Shenanigans this Sunday.
It will be our award show where we just mostly like take pot shots at whatever and give awards for nonsensical categories that we made up specifically to talk about specific games. Somehow sometimes those games will not actually win.
All these things are accurate.
Yeah. This is not an award show that any normal human being should see. I'm sure it will one day end up on Wheels YouTube channel.
It's going on the Q&A quest feed.
Oh, Jesus. As a bonus show.
Fucking jackass.
You can't stop me. Okay. No one can stop me.
Oh, Lord. But yeah. You can also ask us questions by going to the by putting a comment under this episode on rpgamer.com, or you can ask us questions by going to the community tab for rpgamer.com and selecting and joining the Discord. If you go to the podcast section, put a question in there, we're going to look at it at least long enough to determine if it's for us or if it can be reasonably stolen by us. That's the ways you can interact with us that are healthy for both, for all involved. That about wraps it up for us. But I guess I will conclude with the traditional "see you, space cowboy."
See ya.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good mole man to you.
Good mole man to you.
Nice.